Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing Australia's health system from the perspective of health economics, including the problems in the health system, the challenges to reform, and how to improve affordability. My special guest is Professor Tony Scott, the Director of the Centre for Health Economics at Monash Business School. Professor Scott, thank you so much for your time today.
No problem. How are you going, Sam?
I'm very well, thank you. Professor Scott, before we do a deep dive into health economics and the problems within our health system, for our medical audience, could you please tell me a little bit about your background and your passions for this topic?
I'm a health economist. I got a PhD in economics, and I've been interested throughout my career on, I guess, what I call the behaviour of healthcare providers. I think doctors play a very central role in the healthcare system. If you want to change anything to do with the healthcare system, doctors need to be on board because they are the agents of change. You know, when you see a lot of different healthcare systems and how they're financed and the incentives within those systems and how that's all structured, you, particularly in Australia, you realise that the system isn't designed to support doctors. It often gets in the way of what they really want to do or what they're able to do. And so trying to reorient the healthcare system to better support doctors, to improve patient outcomes and keep a lid on costs and make sure the healthcare system is equitable is a very important part of my research agenda.
And Professor Scott, let's turn to the challenges facing primary and secondary care in Australia. From a health economics perspective, what are the issues you see?
Although we have a universal healthcare system, and Medicare will be 40 years old next year, a lot of people still have problems accessing healthcare. And that's because compared to other OECD countries, we still have quite a high rate of out-of-pocket costs. And health insurance, universal health insurance, is supposed to reduce that, is supposed to reduce the financial uncertainty that patients face when they have something wrong with them. And so in that sense, for some groups in the population, for low-income groups particularly, it's not really clear, and there's not much evidence that the healthcare system is doing that. So a lot of people are avoiding visiting their GPs because of cost. Those who can't afford private health insurance are stuck on public hospital waiting lists, which are very long and getting longer. And yet we have quite a large private sector, again, subsidized by government, which obviously gives people the ability to jump the public hospital queues and get treatment straight away. There's some remaining inequalities in the system, and that's an important problem to try and address.
And Professor Scott, let's talk about the interplay between primary care and tertiary care. How does this combined state and federal funding structure create challenges for reform?
I think it creates challenges because it divides the system up into different parts, which don't usually communicate. And the federal government is responsible for some parts of it, Medicare, PBS, and some hospital funding. The states run the hospitals, of course, public hospitals, but also provide other community health services. The way the funding flows creates a disconnect at the patient level where patients, it's hard for them to move between parts of the system. There's not very strong sense of integrated care, particularly with primary care, which is largely funded by the Commonwealth, and hospitals, which are funded by the states. That disconnect is there. The states, in one sense, would love to keep hospital costs low, and that means keeping people out of hospital. For that, you need a strong primary care system or community health care system to kind of do that. But again, each state does things differently, and it's often hard to get them to agree. Just the way the money flows divides the system, I think.
Is there a country or a system that does this better, that joins up primary and tertiary?
There's lots of different systems and each of their advantages and disadvantages. I think a lot of the Scandinavian countries and other systems like that tend to be more integrated. The NHS is obviously in the UK, that's obviously more integrated. But even in the United States, we have integrated healthcare systems there, which have a certain amount of, it's not a geographically based thing, but you know, if you're part of one of these integrated systems, you get all the care that you need, but not everybody has access to that in the US. That's a problem. So each has its problems and issues. And even in fully integrated systems, there's still issues about funding and not enough money going around the system. But we just have to think in Australia about, well, where we are now, how the system is funded, how everything happens, and then, you know, what kind of changes can we make to improve the system from the position we are at now.
And Professor Scott, you recently did research into the market conditions under which doctors work and how doctors operate in a marketplace. How is tackling market forces important in increasing affordability?
As an economist, you're usually taught that markets are good. As a health economist, at least being trained in Europe, we were taught that markets aren't good and don't work in healthcare. Now, markets still exist. Obviously, there's relationships and payments going on, there's freedom of patients to choose which GP they go to. There's freedom of doctors about where they set up and what to charge. So those markets still exist, but really often what you find is private markets reduce access. And so we need to really think about how that interacts with the system of funding. Because doctors have freedom to set prices, that's good for them, because if they can change their prices in response to changes in costs of providing care or changes in government subsidies that patients get to ensure that they, at the minimum, stay in business. But they also need to earn a crust as well. And for GPs, there is some competition in the market, our research has shown, which kind of tends to keep prices down a bit, at least in cities. But for specialists, there isn't much competition, and specialists generally charge very high prices, and they will charge rich people more than poor people. There's evidence to suggest that as well. So again, they operate in a market where the prices may be, for some specialists, maybe too high. And that creates bad incentives in the system. It means that, you know, doctors, young doctors are therefore channeled into specialties with super high earnings and not into general practice where we need them. And that creates a long-standing inability to access care where you haven't got enough GPs, or the balance isn't right between GPs and specialists. So having high prices is good for doctors, but not good for patients. And you might argue that rich patients can pay that. That's fine. It's up to them. But it just creates bad incentives for everybody else in the system, I think.
And Professor Scott, let's look at the solutions. What can be done? What has been done in terms of trying to bring down those out-of-pocket costs?
So what the government isn't able to do is to regulate doctors' fees. That's in the Constitution. There's a belief that can't be challenged, but that hasn't really been tested very strongly. But nevertheless, so on an alternative to that is to operate on the demand side, where you essentially give patients more information about prices. Now, that is tricky because it's up to the doctor how much they charge and whether to bulk bill you or not. You don't often find that out until you're there, until you show up. There's no website for GP prices. I can't find anything. If I want to know the GPs in my area and how much they charge and the chances that they're going to bulk bill me, I've got no website for that. For specialists, there is this My Cost Finder website the Department of Health set up in 2019. And again, with specialist services, again, you get referred from your GP to a private specialist. You might have some idea of what that specialist consultation would cost, that initial consultation, you know, a couple of $100 or whatever. But it's not until you go there and you decide with the specialist that you may want to have some surgery. It's not until then that you know really what the price is. And then it's very difficult to back out or seek another opinion, because it's going to cost you more to see a consultation. And whatever's wrong with you, you're in a vulnerable position. You want this fixed, and most people, if they've got the money, they'll pay anything to get something fixed, right? So people are vulnerable, and I think there's lots of uncertainty about what the out-of-pocket cost will be, and that's entirely up to the doctor. That nowhere in the Australian healthcare system can a patient know exactly how much they're going to be charged before they go down that path. The My Cost Finder website had some information at primary health network level, which is quite a broad geographical area, so you know the average cost to get a hip replaced. But that information is not by doctor. You can't hover over your Google Maps and find a cardiologist and find out what they charge for certain operations. The data is there, but it's not done, and I think that would really improve the market. Markets work on information, and if we haven't got information on quality of doctors or cost of doctors, then patients really can't make informed decisions if they are able to. A lot of healthcare, obviously, emergency care and things like that, patients aren't always in the position to make these decisions. But so, you know, so I think those kind of things are quite important to try to find a way, and I haven't got a way to at least for some patients, for low-income patients, to make it clear upfront whether they're going to get bulk billed or not and what it costs.
And Professor Scott, another possible solution is, of course, increasing subsidies for people in need, perhaps beyond people with a concession card and people who are under 16, to a broader population group.
I think in many ways it's the only way they can go at the moment in the current system. So they've just, with the strengthening Medicare reforms, have just tripled the bulk billing incentives for children and 16s and stuff. So that's important because it means that doctors are more likely to bulk bill. But it's still up to the doctors whether to bulk bill you or not, or to do that, to actually provide that subsidy. Some doctors choose not to, some doctors do. So there's still no guarantee. I mean, that will help, and it's expensive. There's still no guarantee that patients can be bulk billed. There are a few practices around which only do bulk billing. There used to be 10, 15 years ago, you could find a practice which always did bulk bill, no matter what it was for. That was great. After the Medicare fee freeze between 2014 and 2018, those are fewer and far between. Many practices have moved to a mix of bulk billing and private billing, so you can't really tell now whether you're going to get bulk billed or not, depending on which practice you go to.
A very interesting discussion. Professor Tony Scott, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks.
My special guest has been Professor Tony Scott, the Director of the Centre for Health Economics at Monash Business School. You can find more podcasts on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.